Bum, bum, bum.
I think that's as much as we can put on the show without being sued for copyright infringement. I think that's as far as you can go.
We are well outside of our legal limits if I can't get to the third note of the theme from 2001.
Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and getting us in legal trouble is Michael Kester.
Yeah, fuck Ghostbusters.
At the request of John Humpenthal from Kickstarter, you may have heard of this place, Kickstarter.
Been to Kickstarter.
John is actually one of the only people, you know, we made that video, and you came out and said, oh my God, people are going to make me do these terrifying things.
Sure.
And
I believe I said 2001 and Blade Runner.
I think you just said Blade Runner, but if you want to retcon 2001 back in there, it is of the Blade Runner ilk of film.
Yeah.
Actually, people request this a lot less. But we said, yeah, fuck it. We'll do 2001.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. And we're even going to call it 2001 instead of 2001. Because as I previously stated on this show, somewhere back in, I don't know, let's say year one, anytime I can't remember where something is, or maybe I didn't say it on the show, I just claim it was in year one, that we lost year one in a studio fire and no one will be able to prove me wrong.
Right.
But we're going to call it 2001 because that's the only time you use 2001. It would be proper to otherwise call it 2001, but I think it's funny here. So, A Space Odyssey. And we're going to pair it with 2010,
mm-hmm.
the year we made contact.
We're going to spoil these films. Every single one of you, except for me, had seen 2001 a good number of times.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I had seen enough of 2001 just by watching normal.
Yeah, right.
Random things spoil it forever.
Sure.
But we're gonna spoil the parts you didn't know could be spoiled. And then we're going to move on and we're going to spoil the next one 9 years later just as fucking hard. And if you don't like it, you can chapter over it.
Yeah, this is the same problem we have with The Shining. Everyone has seen this movie. They've all seen it more than us,
yep.
sooner than us. I had seen 2001 before.
I had not.
But, I mean, people know the trivia. They've heard commentary. They've read analysis. They know everything about it, and we don't.
Well, yeah, the thing about 2001 for me, and I think I actually made a joke to you when we were discussing something at another point where I was in the middle of watching 2001. We have to watch these separately now because of the amount of miles and mountains in between us. So I was watching 2001 and I was in conversation with you at some point and I said, I'm in the middle of 2001. And you said, what point are you at? How much do you have left? And I said, I know I have a lot left because Hal hasn't said Dave enough.
Right, right.
And that is what 2001 always is for me, is a film that people have quoted and mocked and parodied.
Mm-hmm.
And so going into it, and this whole thing is just an idea of me coming at it from a perspective of someone who's never seen it before, but who has lived in an era of the parody. When I was born, there were zero scary movies. Now there are six. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, right.
So to see 2001 after seeing it made fun of my entire life, I'm sitting there going, oh, here comes the big intro with the planets and oh, here comes the fucking chocolate bar surrounded by monkeys. And here comes fucking that scene where Homer Simpson has to eat all the chips. And
yeah.
The fucking computer with a red bulb. And what, you know, like all this stuff, the iconography that I'm painfully familiar with. Here comes that weird baby. And it's awesome.
Yeah.
It totally stands up. People have been lambasting this thing for years and none of them can do it justice.
Yeah.
Sci-fi movies have been coming out for years, and I think only a handful can amount to the full scope of 2001.
Sure.
It's not my favorite sci-fi movie, but I'd be damned if anybody has made a better sci-fi movie that takes place over a million years.
Right. Right. Well, you also want to talk about epic scale.
Sure.
You know, the movie fucking starts at the dawn of time. Yeah. You can't really be much more ambitious than that, I don't think. And there's also, I mean, that's why there's a joke about Kubrick. You know, that's why there's mm-hmm. Kubrick makes epics. Kubrick makes long movies. its most famous, arguably, we talk about The Shining a lot, but I think most famous movie, or close enough to make my point, is 2001, a film that starts at the dawn of time.
Mm-hmm. And ends when man has evolved beyond man.
Sure.
I think that the parts that people lampoon, the stuff with Dave, the stuff toward the end, that might be what was spoiled for me.
Sure.
Is the actual story of the film, I knew. And so
the dramatic turn of the robot companion.
Yeah, and I was less compelled by that whole idea than I was by secrets on the moon and monkeys pounding a chocolate bar and stuff like that.
Well, we've also come a really long way, and I think during Moon we talked about the state of technology and artificial intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and we'll see that even more in 2010. Being made a little bit closer to modern day, having come after 2001.
Right.
But, you know, those things are so ubiquitous in culture now that we have actual real world things. We have Siri.
Sure.
You know? You can't talk about Siri without thinking about the ideas that Hal put into popular culture, the Arthur C. Clarke ideas that have been written before.
Mm-hmm.
You can ask Siri about 2001 and it'll give you, you know, a robot geared answer. If you ask Siri to describe the movie, it says something to the effect of an assistant named Hal who tried to contact a higher intelligence and two guys got in the way and messed it all up.
Right.
You know, it'll do the same thing for Star Wars. I mean, we have these pieces of technology now that are in, we will not know, being the age we are, what people really thought of Hal when it first came out.
Sure.
Because like you said, especially yourself being so exposed to parody and having not even seen the movie until just now,
mm-hmm.
we've already seen people react to the ideas brought forth in the movie.
Sure.
And then we've seen other movies react to those ideas that people had. And we've seen inventions in our culture that seemed to come back directly. I mean, we probably would have arrived at the idea of Siri and sure. artificial intelligence
right.
and talking to robots and interfacing that way, even without 2001. But when you think back to how people interface with mm-hmm. technology, I think you have to consider a movie like 2001.
Sure.
You have to think about, oh, that's the movie where we talk to the robot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only one of a million things.
Right.
It's also all of the prolific Kubrick, all of the movie opens in epic fashion and completes darkness.
Right.
Kubrick's leaving his audience there without a thing to hang on to. And then, I mean, in a way, it's capturing your attention.
Sure.
I would fear going into a theater where a movie opens in darkness because no one would pay attention.
Right.
But you're sort of sitting there waiting in anticipation for the thing that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then the score is tense. It's you know, it's that guy sitting next to you in the theater, gripping the armrest, going, oh my God, here it comes, it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get your first visuals. And the movie, I think it's also well-cited that there's no dialogue for, you know, 25 minutes or something.
Right, right.
It's this consideration before adding each element, the sound, the visuals, and then finally the dialogue that lends itself to the epic feel of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Without really the film, honestly, being that long for sure. as much as you think
right.
it tackles.
And 2001 is also laden, and I would just like I haven't discussed this with you, but it's laden with this garbage trivia that everybody knows.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. That's the stuff I'm afraid of. People want us to somehow come on here and do that.
I don't care.
No, I don't
about
either.
Why Hal's called Hal,
right.
And I don't care about, did you know that the score wasn't supposed to be the score? And I don't care about, did you know that Stanley Kubrick only ate peanut butter and jelly the entire time? Right. None of that matters to me.
Yeah.
I think that possibly the only thing of trivial note for me in this entire film is the monolith.
Yeah.
I think that the trivia and really, and it does stand, it stands to reason because the monolith is the only thing from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, sure.
It is, for all intents and purposes, a pillar of existence.
I'm so happy you love the Monolith. I have an obsession with fucking Monolith.
Well, it's the kind of thing that's it's wonderful in its simplicity, and it's impossible to be replicated. I'm sitting here watching 2001 for the first time, right? Going, I'm going to get a tattoo of the Monolith.
Yeah, right.
And then I'm thinking, no, I'm not. That is a black rectangle.
Yeah, right. How do you make something look? It is. It's this perfect, beautiful object. Just perfect in every way.
Yeah. And there's there were Monolith toys made.
Sure.
Again, how do you make a toy of the Monolith? It's a black rectangle.
Right.
But I mean, it's everybody's fascinated by this thing's simplicity. And this is where I will get into a little bit of trivia, is that Kubrick has stated that there was initially to be a scene where the Monolith was an alien spacecraft. Cut it out because he didn't think that it was necessary.
Sure.
So fine with that.
You get enough idea about what the Monolith is, though. Don't right. I mean, you see the monkeys touch it, and suddenly they're using tools.
Right. It's,
you know, you need no dialogue for it.
Yeah, that's the thing, is the Monolith is basically a symbol of intelligent life in the universe, and it also it keeps a watchful eye on that life which may bear intelligence.
Sure.
It's omnipresent and omni-badass and absolutely untattooable.
Well, and this is what I'm talking about in these icons and then in Kubrick's treatment, because I don't think it's a mistake that the film that features all of these things that everybody remembers also happens to be made by this auteur director who is so exacting and so perfectionistic.
Mm-hmm.
The way he treats the things in the movie, I mean, it's part of the reason you remember them. You don't just remember Hal because Hal was a great idea. You remember it because of the way Kubrick treats it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Monolith, which is still, I mean, every fucking frame of this movie is an icon. But the Monolith, I feel like, is one of the most unsung things for how much the movie goes, look at the icon.
Mm-hmm.
But it is this, you know, you're watching a bunch of mangy monkeys running around, fucking fur is a mess. And where are they? They're in this, you know, beautifully shot, but still chaotic rubble, you know, a bunch of sand and fucking rocks that are misshaped in different sizes. Nothing is symmetrical. It's a fucking mess. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of all of it, is this object of harmony, of sleek, simple perfection. It's a rectangle. That's it. But it's great for me to hear you mention that, as me, the one always going on and on about simplicity and minimalism, is it's instantly recognizable for you as, yeah, there it is, simplicity and harmony and perfection sitting amongst a bunch of apes who clearly need it. And so, you know, they learn to use tools and they're bestowed this knowledge, and it feeds into this theme of evolutionary progress, of pushing along the evolution. Well, you think about the rest of the movie, and it's all harmony,
mm-hmm.
the whole fucking thing. The end of the movie is too much fucking harmony. But you get in the spaceship and the look of things, it's a wide angle lens, but it's this mathematical grid-based design symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Every shot in the ship is perfect 45 degree angles, perfect horizontal and vertical. Everything is grid-based. Everything lays out symmetrically. The people are in the frame symmetrically. You know, they're talking in the pod and Hal is immediately in the center of them. The wide angle lens warps it a little bit. It actually kind of restores some of the humanity to it. But the only time we see that clunky chaos is in the beginning, when man is before man, before the dawn of man, in a clunky state of chaos. And the first perfect symmetrical object we see is the Monolith. You also have to think about, I think, the time the movie came out, 1968.
Right.
We hadn't even walked on the fucking moon yet.
Mm-hmm.
When people talk about how 2001 has influenced other sci-fi films, we didn't even know what actual space looked like. Our concept, you and I have never been to space, as we have previously discussed on the Critters episode of the show, but I'm still racing you there. We think of space, it's probably actually a lot less like 2001 than we think of in our heads.
Mm-hmm.
It is so influential. It crafts what people actually think real space looks like.
Sure.
The idea of the silence that became an easy but a really powerful go-to in other space films. And just this infinite blackness and the... You have to think about what came before 2001. Our treatment of space was far more monster-oriented, spacesuits and hoses everywhere and these sets. 2001 really felt like you were in space. You got to feel zero mm-hmm. gravity, and these, you know, there's these great lengths to go through with moon gravity shoes and
yeah.
sets that rotate and all of this.
Tons of whatever devices.
To go, ooh, look, we're in space. And Kubrick sat down and he said, all right, I'm going to define what space looks like for fucking ever, even more so than actual space will define it. And he goes, well, it's symmetrical. It's, you know, it's a lot of that harmony.
Mm-hmm.
Truth be told, these are probably just as much about his themes of evolution through the movie. But because the way he makes space look is feeding into those themes really become a lot of what space is about for us. It's humbling and it's big. We are made of star stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this kind of a theme we'll see again in 2010 of people all becoming one and moving towards the future. Kubrick would have such an influence on this that people think he fucking faked the, you know, the moon landing.
Right.
The amount of conspiracy, there's that whole Shining documentary.
Room 237.
Yeah, about, you know, Kubrick conspiracies and crazy things people think. But this movie actually features its own hoax. It has the cover story of the epidemic, which itself is already of conspiratorial nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, there's an epidemic. The government doesn't want us to know. But that's only, you know, it's a hoax perpetrated to cover up, you know, the monolith and what's going on. The moon hoax itself has been really prevalent since the mid-70s, but I would imagine it had to occur immediately when we showed the footage. Because you and I look at that and go, oh yeah, Kubrick faked the moon landing. What is that, the only director's name, you know? But what a far-fetched idea.
This year it'd be J.J. Abrams, but yeah.
Well, back when Kubrick's doing this, people are going, well, he's the only one who has the power to show what space really looks like.
Sure.
He's the only one who's there yet.
Right.
Everybody else's filmmaking technology hasn't advanced that
Spielberg
far yet.
Hasn't even done Duel yet.
Right.
I mean, Star Wars isn't there yet.
Right, yeah.
There are not even cinematic battles in space at this point.
Yeah.
And Kubrick has... I mean, again, the scope of the film is what's so breathtaking, is he's not only gone and defined space, but he's defined it from the standpoint of where man is. Goes, man was monkeys, then man was doing shady dealings on the moon. Now this is what space is.
I believe you're leaving a phase of our evolution out of that summary. It's the part where we go on an acid trip.
That would be the 1968 human step of evolution. Right. That's the step from 68 to the summer of love.
Oh, my God. Yeah, so I want to talk about this specifically because nobody else ever wants to.
Right.
They get as far as Hal and they go, yeah, that was a good movie. And they leave out the fucking insane part.
The film basically, for me, in my understanding, I didn't know that this happened.
I didn't either the first time I saw it.
I'm surprised more people don't parody this. This is the most simple and amusing thing to do. To basically go, here's my film, easy to follow, yada, 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 giant space baby, credits.
right. So, I mean, I don't know. Do you feel like you have any hold on what's going on in the third act of
this?
Well,
I've seen all of the Rob Zombie music videos.
Right.
So, one of the things that... No, okay, sorry. I do really want to give this some credit. I understand what's going on. I get what is supposed to be happening. I follow it. I mean, how else do you show rapid evolution? How else do you show transcendence?
Mm-hmm.
How else do you, I mean, the closest thing mankind will ever come to spiritual transcendence, despite years of painstaking evolution, is LSD.
Yeah, sure.
So,
also just the way, you know, you have the colors flying at you and
right,
and then going back to his horror face,
yeah,
which I love,
yeah,
just constant, you know, music visualization service,
sure,
color schemes. You're watching somebody's screensaver,
mm-hmm,
and then cut back to his frozen, mortified face. Mm-hmm. It's like the most off-putting, terrifying thing in the movie. But yeah, you get this idea that you're traveling. You
right.
know, it denotes traveling. It denotes some kind of...
Sure.
You could get really... it's a canal. There's
sure.
sperm in the visualization.
Right.
We're going to be talking about a fetus soon.
I think...
But yeah, there's transcendence.
Don't get me wrong. I think that if ever there were a moment in his filmography, this is the point where you can go, Stanley Kubrick, you indulgent fuck.
Well, I love that too. Let's humanize
right.
even the scariest filmmakers that we've talked about.
It's just a moment where, I mean, you get the silence and the darkness at the beginning of the film, and I want so badly to shake my fists and say, Stanley Kubrick, you indulgent fuck. But when it starts, I go, Stanley Kubrick, you goddamn genius.
Yeah, right. What a masterpiece.
But when I'm watching 15 minutes of a Windows Media Player visualization, Stanley Kubrick, you indulgent fuck.
It's true.
Granted,
he's earned it at that point, right? I mean, come on.
Anybody's
earned it. 2001. If you want to go, hey, and here's my LSD wormhole, then whatever, it's fine.
It doesn't, I don't think it takes away from the movie. I think that that is definitely a stride that you can applaud Stanley Kubrick for.
Well, and also, this is just a time lapse, man. He might be
right.
showing you a trillion years of evolution.
Right.
It only takes you 15 minutes.
It's a movie barcode of the entire evolution.
Right. Hey, Kubrick, thanks for speeding that scene up, because we know you wanted your movie to be 1 billion years long.
Right.
And instead, we went through all of human evolution, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Or I imagine. So we arrive in this room. That's more the enigma. You're watching this thing going, I get it. I think I still get it. And then you show up in the room. And if you haven't lost it by then, when you get the fetus in a bubble, you're just...
Mm-hmm.
You're lying to yourself if this is the first time watching the movie and you go, yeah, fetus in a bubble. Nope, totally got it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something has to throw you off. And honestly, when I'm in the room, that's where I'm starting to lose it a little bit.
Right.
But I mean, okay, so go through this with me. What are we seeing in this room?
Some
kind of Victorian room, right? I'm just
right.
going to ignore the look of the room because, you know, visual aesthetics.
I mean, I hesitate to say that it's literally a place where aliens have put a human being to live out the rest of his life.
Yeah.
I think in line with the acid trip, it's more symbolic than it is
sure.
a literal bottom lit room.
But we are seeing some things that are tangible. We're seeing the aging.
Sure. You know? Well, and the pod is in there.
So we cut away and we cut back and we cut away and we cut back. And eventually there's a baby there.
Right.
So the baby has to be him. Right. I mean,
right.
he disappears from the spot he was in. Then there's a baby there.
Right.
So he has transformed into this baby at
right.
this point.
Sure.
I feel like that's about the most tangible spot you're going to get.
Yeah.
Then he probably journeys back as the fetus in the bubble. They just don't want to show us another 15 minutes of wormhole.
Right.
But I mean, the unsatisfying answer here, and you know, you watch this and you kind of want the satisfying answer. I think the real answer, however unsatisfying, is it's open to interpretation.
Right.
The ending is intentionally, purposefully vague in an attempt to get the viewer, I think successfully, to ponder what is happening.
Sure. Well, I think that there is one interesting clue in this baby, and it's that at the beginning of the film, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I might just be misremembering, I've only seen it once. But we get a title card that says The Dawn of Man, and then it shows some monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
Do we get any more title cards after that?
There is one.
There's years that have gone by.
Yeah, I guess we just didn't have a date for The
right.
Dawn of Man. You know, it does
so,
Jupiter, the infinite
right.
sadness.
Is it possible?
Sorry, that's not.
So is it possible that then 2001 A Space Odyssey is actually an overarching million-year story about the true dawn of man, and we're going, The Dawn of Man, and then it's a movie about that, and it ends with, and now man has evolved.
Oh, sure, I see what you mean. Some scope, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious about the travel back to Jupiter, and, you know, I think a lot about why a fetus, because that's the current part. Every sure. time I watch this movie, I'm sort of stuck on a different part. And presently, it's, you know, you get the cyclical nature, you get the went from monkey nothing to fetus is an origin point, right? Mm-hmm. It's, hey, this is what the beginning of life looks like. If you're going to paint a picture of the beginning of life, you paint a fucking fetus.
Right.
And then you put it in a bubble because it's evolved a little bit.
Well, because it's in space.
It's imagery. And I don't think you can really look at it tangibly, even though the more abstract a movie is, the more I want to point to it. Look at our conversation on Only God Forgives. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were really able to hash through that, connect some serious themes to what's going on and kind of point to terms of phrase or, you know, different ideas that might have invoked different symbols.
Right.
Very hard to do that with 2001, except to go, we're talking about evolution. There's a natural connection to birth, to the human life cycle, both, you know, with an individual human going from fetus to death, and then saying, well, the cycle of humanity from the beginning of the first human to the death of the last human. I don't know if we can answer questions like, why is he in the room? And why is the room in that particular style? Why does the bed look that way? Why is he the one person that they, I don't know, picked? Did they pick him?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we have answers to these things, even though transition time 2010 will attempt to answer some of them.
Right.
Oh my God, it's full of stars. I just had to be the first one to say it.
So 2010, the year we make contact.
Already we're getting hints in the title, right?
Yeah.
We're going, okay, we're back just a couple years from the end of all humanity or
mm-hmm.
the end of the last step of our evolutionary progress
sure.
or whatever. We're just going to speed up a couple years.
Well, I think that the film, it definitely, there's two big points before we dive into the actual subject matter of the film.
Yeah.
One is that it takes some really dubious avenues in retconning some of the parts of the first film that are either difficult to reconcile or that create some pulp for a meaty sequel. I go directly to Hal's not such a bad guy.
Yeah.
Well,
we never got our explanation of the right. malfunction
exactly.
in the first one.
Right.
So we kind of bring that up in the next.
Sure.
And I don't think you just want Hal to play scary robot again.
Right.
That's what we talked about a little in Moon, is we've seen that. I don't know if we want to go right back there.
For me, if I were to make a sequel of 2001, which one I probably would never ever do because I don't know how, you reboot Hal and it's, what the fuck are you doing? You don't bring Darth Vader back from the dead.
Yeah.
You know sure. what I mean? I mean, Hal is the villain.
Yeah.
You do not bring the villain back unless you want more villainy.
But at the same time, you're making a sequel to this movie. You can't really have any of the original characters, although we do sort of do that.
Because mm-hmm.
after you transcend time and space, you can kind of sure. fucking make up your own rules. But it makes sense. Bring the. So we told this whole story. We brought you, the viewer, through the beginning and end of Man.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going, well, let's try and tell part of that story again. Let's jump back to where humanity is still at in present day.
Right.
And so the only types of things you can have around are, well, can we get the robot voice back? We can do that, right?
Right.
It's hard thinking about this as sure. a sequel, and what do you do?
Well, and it's already been written. This whole novelization has been written
sure.
by Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote 2001 with Stanley Kubrick, but then went on and wrote, there's a 2010 and I think a 2021. Are the other two installments.
I didn't know that.
But so the...
But yeah, so he wrote it after the previous movie had come
right.
out.
Right. So, I mean, you do have the idea of original creator creating original content on original content,
mm-hmm.
which to me is always way less bastardizing than big studio gets a hold of a property, wants more money from property, creates unnecessary sequel to property.
Sure.
So there's definitely the idea that there is a story to be told beyond the dawn of man.
Yeah.
That's what 2010 does. It tells you the story you didn't realize you were missing when you're glancing at the scope of mankind from start to finish. Right. You didn't realize that there was a little blip
in there.
There's a little important. Blip that was important.
It does make it seem so much less, important. You know what I mean? It's really hard to come back from an epic and go, hey, the Cold War's going on. Why don't we tell a story about that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just talked about everything that was, is, and will be. And now you're going to go, and the Cold War is happening right now. I'm going to write a story about that.
Sure.
It's infinitely minute by comparison.
But if you look at it as a human being, it's far more identifiable to hear a story about the battles on Earth and the tribulations of the people who have escaped the petty squabblings of mankind for a few years.
Right.
Than it is to look at, this was pretty much the saga of space. But you don't get the human element that you get by seeing these scientists in space watching their homes shoot the shit out of each other.
Yeah.
You get these transmissions. Hey, so you sitting over there, your dad nuked her mom.
Yeah, right.
Yesterday. So you guys need to split up.
Yeah.
Not okay anymore. This you sitting next to each other bullshit. Uh-uh. Separate lunch tables.
I know.
Different water fountains.
That's weird, isn't it? Yeah, to go, this is happening back on Earth, and therefore we're going to need you guys to fight up. I don't know if you've ever had, I'm sure people email us thousands of examples, and actually I'd be curious to look into every single fucking one of them, but you make an epic, and then you make a personal kind of story. It's not really personal, but I guess just in contrast.
Sure, right.
We still, even the title is still kind of epic.
Mm-hmm.
2010, the year we make contact, which was not the title everywhere.
Right. It's also a little exploitative because the contact that we make is unbeknownst to us. It's kind of third party contact.
Sure.
We built this guy who then we reboot who makes contact.
Yeah. Well, friend of a friend. That's how information is disseminated.
That's how you contact.
Listen, he's not going to come into your living room. Okay.
Right.
That's just how the alien movies make it seem like it's going to be. What happens anytime you discover any news is that somebody tells somebody who tells a room full of people who figure out how to tell other people, and you're always the 50th person to fucking know.
Right.
So now you're just 51 because somebody told the robot first.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no human being was directly talked to by the monolith. Although Dave comes back.
Dave comes back.
So there is a little bit of conversation with a being who used to be human or whatever.
Who contains all of the things that used to compose Dave.
So in a way, they're talking directly to us, but I don't think a monolith can talk directly to us.
Sure.
So it uses the intermediary of everybody's favorite lovable robot from the previous film.
Well, and the thing that I think that 2010 also exploits that I've always thought is a very important idea when it comes to contact with alien life is the notion that a computer is going to be easier to communicate with than an organic being with language and symbols and different cultural.
Sure.
I mean, if you look at the diversity of, say, a wink on Earth, here in the United States, that's just a thing you do when you're flirting. Oftentimes, there are some European countries where you just do it. It has no romantic implications. In some Asian countries, it's insulting. I mean, that's one planet. Now imagine a universe.
Yeah, sure.
And so the idea of making contact with alien life for me has always boiled down to numbers. Numbers being the hardest fact that we can understand of the universe outside of our understanding of the composition of, say, the atom.
Right.
And so to have to speak to a human being, they'd have to learn our language, learn our symbols, learn what's offensive. To speak to a computer, they need to know binary.
Well, also, the monolith isn't quite just an alien race.
Right.
It seems to be, the tool through which they promote progress. And there is something very all-knowing about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really sure that the language barrier is the reason so much as honestly you're building a story and I really do think you want Hal back. Otherwise, the other problem you run into with an epic is you just basically talked about everything that could be talked about ever because you made a film about the entirety of time. So your next film could literally be anything. Office Space could be the sequel to 2001. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Any story that's ever happened in humanity is the fucking sequel to 2001. So you kind of got to go, well, what makes it a sequel? Do we bring characters back? How are we writing, you know, a sequel? I guess talking about the event of 2001, talking about things like the monolith, we have to return to those notions. Same time, we don't just want to rehash 2001. It's a thing that's already been made. I think I have a real soft spot for this movie. Can you believe the pressure that these people must be under in making the sequel? Mm-hmm. It's like making a fucking remake of Citizen Kane. You know what I mean?
Right.
You ask people you have to build a list. I've just tasked you to build a list of greatest films of all time that, you know, is going to go on the AFI list or the IMDb list or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're part of an organization, not personally your films,
right,
but greatest achievements by man.
Sure.
I mean, it's pretty much going to be 2001 and Citizen Kane. Those are the go-tos that people just, you know, Godfather. I mean,
yeah.
And somebody's going, hey, Michael, I need you to go ahead and make Godfather Part 4.
Mm-hmm.
Or you sign on to it. I don't want to sound like the director is a fucking victim or something.
Sure.
But, you know, you have an opportunity, Michael. Do you think you could go ahead and make the fourth Godfather?
Yeah. Can we do Citizen Kane The Reckoning?
Yeah. Some directors are going to turn that down. But for a lot of people, that's a job. That's a chance to do something. I mean, could you imagine creating the follow-up to 2001?
Right.
Your name is going to be known even if you do nothing in your movie. It's given this, you're being given this huge opportunity. Yet the other side of me, I mean, I'm watching it and they're doing previously on 2001. I can't fucking believe I'm watching this.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe this is a thing that exists. What if someone told you there was a sequel to Citizen Kane? I mean, that's crazy to think about that.
Sure.
And they have text scrolling across the screen. It's like a no fucking kidding sequel. Like, hey, for everybody who didn't see 2001, last time, if you'll remember, there was a domino that came down from space.
It's the beginning
of guys.
It's the beginning of an unfortunately unrealized Spaceapalooza.
I know. Isn't that crazy? It's like a slasher sequel.
Yeah, if you take any of our slasher franchises, with a few exceptions, you look at, I mean, for me, it's always going to be Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right? You look at Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the fucking Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Everyone's seen it.
Sure.
Then there's sequels, and immediately people are going, why is this? What is this? How is this? What are we?
Yeah.
Did you not see the first one? Could we have just been done there?
Yeah.
And you get these sequels that have to explore facets of an already painfully, perfectly established creation.
Yeah.
Without seeming like they're exploiting it.
Well, so there's no winning. I mean, what do? You're tasked to make this sequel. You can't just rip off the previous film.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, for starters, you're not going to be able to do that as well as Kubrick did.
Right.
Kubrick is the worst person to have to be the follow-up act to. You know what I mean? We've talked, every time we talk about Kubrick, we talk about how he spends a trillion years making a scene and he does 5,000 fucking takes and everything is perfect. And then he burns all his goddamn sets and you're supposed to make the sequel, you know? How long do you think it would take you and I, with relatively little filmmaking experience, to recreate a single frame, a photograph from this movie, given an infinite budget?
Yeah.
I mean, it's nuts. It's absolutely crazy. And so you got to put people on the same ship again. How the fuck are you going to do that? So you can't rip the previous one off because you can't do it as well. And also, you don't just want to be a Stanley Kubrick ripoff.
Mm-hmm.
But then it seems that anything you do differently is suddenly wrong. You and I talked about Hal. You're not going to have Hal be as subtly menacing as before. You can't do that. But if you have Hal be a nice robot, it also kind of seems, I mean, I'm right there with you. It seems a little weird.
Right.
You have a Sal 9000 asking it to explain the metaphor of a phoenix. I mean, that one scene alone divorces you from Kubrick. But it's still a film that got the so-called blessing, what was the Django thing?
Oh, friendly participation?
Yeah, you got the friendly participation of Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick.
Hal.
Hal, and you get original actors.
Sure.
I would think that's one of the things you try to do.
Sure.
Is go, no, look, the other people who made this don't just think it's a bastardized thing. They think it's okay. I mean, they're willing to hang around. You put John Lithgow in it. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
I'm not really, John Lithgow, who I see his name in the opening, and I spend the whole time just wishing and hoping it's the same John Lithgow I'm thinking, and not just a coincidence that there's some obscure British actor named John Lithgow. Also, Bob Balaban, uh-huh. who we just saw in Moonrise,
right,
has hair in this in this movie. You know, we have some people that are honestly, for me, more recognizable than the actors who were in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
But I start thinking about things like Star Wars.
Right.
You get the original fucking guy who made Star Wars, George Lucas. You bring him back. And he's had his hands in Star Wars for decades since it's transpired. He's been tweaking it and honing it to, you know, the disagreement of everybody who's a fan of it, I guess.
Yeah, but you know, fuck you, he made it, so.
Yeah, right. Okay, so he comes back and he makes more Star Wars. And even the original goddamn guy can't make it to audience satisfaction.
Sure.
So now you go, Stanley Kubrick, same kind of fucking place that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
He's not really going to make the movie for you. You know, he's not going to be there telling you how he would do it. He wants you to, you know, be able to do your own thing. And what are the chances you're going to make something that people are okay with mm-hmm. that doesn't get you death threats? I don't know. I just think that's a really hard spot to be in. And I think that is the most notable thing about 2010.
Yeah.
That it is a sequel to this unanimously critically acclaimed
sure.
Masterpiece. It's really kind of a template by, if you did a film class on masterpieces, you would study 2001.
Yeah, you would. There's four films you'd study, and 2001 is three of them.
And so given all the directions you could go, I mean, I don't know. I'm just interested in this as a case study of what kind of movie do you make after that. It's also interesting to see how people did react. I got off on the wrong foot with this movie because the cover has the fucking fetus on it.
Right.
So already it's kind of spoiling a classic, and it's picking up the one icon that I just really, the fetus in the bubble is what we're going with. But I was very interested in what is the popular opinion. And I don't know if you know anything about the reviews from this movie or if you've ever seen anybody's reaction to it. Do you even know anybody who's seen this?
I probably do. I never had to ask anybody about it because I myself had never seen it.
Think about how much you had known from the first movie.
Yeah.
You didn't know anything from this movie.
Yeah.
Right?
No, that's true.
I think most people don't know it exists. But I was curious, all right, is this going to be just, I assume the popular reaction to this is a bastardized sequel to
sure.
2001.
It was well received. I did do some research just out of curiosity on when it came out and what was right. going on.
Well, yeah, because you wonder, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
You kind of get the era the film's in, what it's talking about. It's in good company. It's almost too easy, the kind of, oh, hey, everybody, go live in harmony sort of idea.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do love all the planets are yours except Europa. The message is, you guys, get along with each other, but also stay off my fucking lawn. It's sort of, you leave Europa the fuck alone. You stay away from us. But also, isolationism isn't really the way to progress society. And why don't you all come together and live peacefully on the planets? Fucking hypocritical alien assholes. But sorry, so the popular opinion of this movie, much like all reviews, they're all the same fucking thing. Every review can be summed up as, once you realize it's not 2001, it's actually a pretty good film. That's what everybody thinks about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting that the popular opinion sort of swayed the other way.
Right.
That people all knew that everyone would come out and hate this. So I think they were all kind of ready to go, man, poor film is some big shoes to fill. You know what? No, I'm going to fucking like this movie. Hey, we know it's not Kubrick, but this is a pretty good space film. And so I don't know, I guess a bullet successfully dodged.
Yeah.
All right, so we got some producers who are all mad at us for pairing these two movies. That is Lucas Drewal, Enrique, Mike Shaw, Dust, and Eric Tachek. I wanted to pair these two movies together because of what I thought the popular impression of 2010 was,
mm-hmm.
which is fuck that movie. It's terrible. It ruins the first movie, you know, the things that people sure. would say.
Matrix.
Yeah, and I think most people actually didn't say that. Or maybe the self-selected people who write reviews for the film. I mean, I don't know. I have no way of really telling.
Right.
But you know that 2001 is It's one of those films that is such a masterpiece that we haven't done it on the show because what the fuck do you pair it with?
Mm-hmm.
The same fucking Shining problem, which is just everybody talks so highly of this film that anything you put next to it is going to be like, oh, fuck you, boo. And I was really interested in what do people think about 2010. Also, it's kind of a funny joke, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you pair it with the sequel. Of course, there's a natural reason to pair the two. But inherent in pairing the two, you go, oh, really? You're going to put them on the same level?
Right.
Like they're even the same fucking thing at all? Which is what you do when you make a sequel. You kind of put yourself unfairly on that level.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really funny reason to pair the two. It's probably putting 2010 in the best light that we can. And even with it being an impossible act to follow, we still want to come on here and find the best things about movies,
mm-hmm.
to put movies in the best possible light. And I don't know, in covering movies like this, if we're ever going to discover anything new that hasn't been talked about before. But I think we may be the first place that just gave equal weight and time to 2001 and 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's all we accomplished today, I'm totally fine with that.
Next time we're actually going to try to move a little bit further on our this year's journey, which is our Universal Monsters and our Originators of Sci-Fi double features.
Whoops. Let's just forget this show ever happened.
So we'll be doing Boris Karloff in The Mummy, and we will be pairing that with the classic Logan's Run.
It'll be fine.
It'll be, yeah, I'm not worried. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.